Greet each one in Jesus' name this morning. It's good to be together in the house of God. Enjoyed that Old Testament story of God at work and God communicating his message to the man of God, David. I'm going to go to an Old Testament story this morning for a message. Turn with me to 1 Kings chapter 19. Look at the story of Elijah calling Elisha to take up his ministry. At least it's the call where he began working with Elijah till the point then a number of years later when Elijah was taken away. This message grew in my heart as I read through this story this week or last week, maybe thinking about a message for this week. Partly thinking about minister ordination here in 2 weeks. But also the lessons from this story are much broader than just the call to ministry in the church in that way. And so we'll see that as we go through. 1 Kings chapter 19. If you look at the beginning of the chapter, Elijah flees to Mount Horeb. He flees from Jezebel. After that, Mount Carmel experience, and Elijah had prayed and stopped the rain for 3 years, then the Mount Carmel experience, and then Elijah prayed and it brought rain, and then he flees for his life, and he sits discouraged on the mountain, and God tells him to get up and go call some people to lead and call Elisha to lead in your stead. And so verse 19 is the story. So he, Elijah, departed thence and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen before him, and he with the 12th. And Elijah passed by him and cast his mantle upon him. And he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, "Let me, I pray thee, kiss my father and my mother, and then I will follow thee." And he said unto him, "Go back again, for what have I done to thee?" And he returned back from him and took a yoke of oxen and slew them and boiled their flesh with the instruments of the oxen and gave unto the people, and they did eat. Then he arose and went after Elijah and ministered unto him. It's kind of a fascinating story, a strange ordination service. As Elijah just walked past Elisha and placed his mantle on him, the significance, perhaps we don't understand that in that culture, but Elisha knew the call by that. He understood what that meant, and he understood it was going to cause some change in his life. And he worked through that. So the first point that I'd like to talk about in this morning's message is that Elijah, a mighty prophet, neared the close of his ministry. So this foundational point is that Elijah was nearing the close of his ministry, and someone else needed to take it up. And that's what was calling for that in this event. And we had noted how he had challenged wicked King Ahab, and he had prayed to stop the rain. And God told him to go and anoint Elisha in his stead. One of the things that we see Elijah wrestling with is his feelings. And I'd like you to look at verse 4 here in chapter 19. As Elijah was wrestling with his feelings, the end of verse 4, "It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am not better than my fathers." For I am not better than my fathers. He is wrestling with feelings that I'm no good, or he's comparing himself to his fathers. It almost seems like he's saying, "I haven't done any more than my fathers. I haven't accomplished more than those before me." And I raised the question, so why should Elijah feel bad that he didn't do something that those before him didn't do? There's this there's this wrestling that God, I'm no good because I didn't make my own mark, maybe he's saying. I didn't shake the world worse than my father's. See, Elijah is nearing the close of his ministry, and he's looking at his life, and he's realizing that what the Ecclesiastes writer said, there's nothing new under the sun. Even when men invent something, it's been before in many ways. And Elijah's realizing that I was just a human. I just did the work of God, and it's not a whole lot different than the men that went before. And he's actually feeling down and blue about this because I'm just a man. Hebrews 5 talks about high priests are taken from among men, and it tells us why. So that they can have compassion on them because they are also compassed about with infirmity. And so here's this idea of Elijah, a powerful man of God, sitting at the end of his life saying, well, I was just a man. Well, guess what, Elijah? Didn't you realize that before? That's all we are. And while he had done great works and while he had done many things, the reality in light of eternity was he was just a man. And he did what God gave him. And though they were powerful and though there was miracles wrought, yet he was a man. And he started to look and say, but all I did was what men do. And we sit here this morning thinking about it, saying, well, of course, Elijah, because that's all you were as a man. But I think you understand the underlying thing, because as God calls us to any kind of work, whether it's school teaching or whether it's to be a father, whether it's in the work of the church and ministry, sometimes, you know, it's good. We have aspirations of doing well and growth and doing better than our fathers. But at some point in time, we realize my work is a lot very similar to what others have done because I'm just a man. Verses 10 and 14 in this passage, he says to God, I'm alone. I alone am faithful. Verse 10 and 14 are just about exactly the same. And he said, I have been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thy altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away. Elijah was feeling pretty blue that I'm the only one left. I'm no better than my fathers, and I'm the last man standing, is what he was saying. It's a pretty sorry place to be emotionally in our mind. Well, in verses 11 through 13, God showed himself to Elijah. And God said in verse 11, go forth and stand upon the mount before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great strong wind rent the mountains and brake in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still small voice. And that's where the Lord was, in the still small voice. And it was so when Elijah heard it that he wrapped his face in his mantle and he went out and stood in the entering of the cave. And behold, there came a voice unto him that said, what doest thou here? Continue to talk with him. I think that what God was doing is God was showing him is I can blow strong winds. I can shake mountains, but my presence is in a still small voice that works in hearts. See, Elijah was wrestling. I didn't shake mountains. Well, he did on Mount Carmel. Wasn't that a powerful thing? In many ways, it was just what a man can do. It was the power of God. It didn't change those wicked followers of Ahab. Those Baal worshipers, they were slain. Where God's power is, yes, it's in nature, yes, it's in storms, yes, and all that, but the power to change lives is a powerful thing needed in ministry. And as Elijah was reflecting on this, God showed him that I am the God of storms, I am the God of all this, but I'm also the God that works in hearts in still small voices. And so, As Elijah was nearing the end of his ministry here, he's wrestling with things that men wrestle with. And God showed him that I am in the still small voice. There I will meet you. There I will be with you. Stop pitying yourself. You're not the only one. I have 7,000 that have not bowed their knee to Baal in verse 18. There's many others. They were silent, apparently. They were Elijah. They weren't right out there supporting Elijah. They were hiding themselves for their lives, or at least finding a way to exist under wicked King Ahab. But there, as I think about this first point, there are several challenges to take up a work after or alongside of others. So Elijah, this powerful man, was at the end of his life, and Elisha was to take up the work. There are several challenges. One is the feeling of inadequacy. Elisha, what's interesting about this is Elijah, though, is the man first feeling inadequate and feeling like he didn't shake the world like his any more than his father's. But Elisha would come to wrestle with that question. Can I actually fill the shoes of Elijah? In fact, he gets to the place where he asks for a double portion of his spirit. He says, Elijah, I want a double blessing from you. And it's part of that idea that I can't do it myself. I'm going to need the Spirit of God that is with you. So there's often feelings of inadequacy. There's often comparisons that intimidate. And it goes like this. So the one newly called, and let's just take a simple example that we can probably connect with. When we've had a first grade teacher at school for many, many years that did a wonderful job, and she quits and someone else needs to take her place, it's pretty scary, because we compare someone who has the practice and the experience, and that's what we need to do as we get involved in service. We want to grow and do better and better. And so someone has been serving for many, many years, and now someone else must come in and take up the work, and they're at the starting point, and we compare the starting point to the finishing point, and it looks impossible. And we must understand that. If we are the one called to take the place, we must understand it. And if we are the onlookers, we must understand it. Because the poor person who takes that one's place, who is doing well, can't possibly fill the if they start where that one left off, well, praise the Lord, but we're going to go through the roof. If you know, everyone has to start somewhere. And it's important that we understand that, because the reality of much of this point is that we are all just human, and we need to reckon with the fact that we probably can't do much more than our fathers did. But we need to do what we do right and grow and try to do better, try to grow and learn. But don't get too high-minded, because we probably can only do what our fathers did. I don't know if you can wrap that whole thing in this first point, but that's what I was seeing, was a man who Elijah put his best in there, and he really did things. And we look at it and we say, what a great man. Came down to it, he felt like, not much more than my fathers. And in God's sight, even the greatest of men are not much more than their fathers. See, what did Jesus say? That we're supposed to, when we have done that which we are unprofitable servants, we have done that which was our duty to do. And so we're just doing what we're to do, and just have that kind of humility. Well, so point number two that I'd like to talk about in this story is that Elisha was a man of power and success. Not many farmers, I'm told, had 12 yoke of oxen in that day. It says that he was plying with 12 yoke of oxen, and it looks like he was bringing up the tail. So there was 11 yoke of oxen out ahead of him. He was plying with the 12. So it reminds me of 12 yokes of oxen out through. The first one plowing a furrow, and the next one the next furrow. 12 yoke of oxen plowing. This is a big farming operation. This man has servants who know what they're doing. This man owns animals. This man has the plows to hook behind. This man has taught his workers how to handle these oxen. This man is fruitful. This man is not afraid of hard work. This man is diligent. This man has grown his farm. It doesn't tell us how long it took him to get to this place of 12 yoke of oxen, but this could be many, many years. And he labored and he worked, and each year he added a yoke of oxen, however it went. This is a man who's has some vision, can do what needs to be done today, but knows how to grow it for the future and is working on it. Do you think he had any backsets? he probably did, because that's usual in life. But he just kept on, and he kept on. And there was success in that. And he had servants working for him. And so we can conclude from that that he had to be the kind of man that you can work for. Not all of his employees quit and walked away from him. So he had some kind of people skills to keep men working for him, running these yokes of oxen and helping with the farm. It seems he loved his physical labor and he was good at it. And, you know, he could have even come to really enjoy this power and accomplishment. And he's probably one of those men at the end of the day, after the clean furrows were plowed, and you can just, those of you that have some farm background, can just smell that fresh dirt after plowed, or after you mowed the hay, that fresh the evening smell of the fresh mowed hay. He's a man that, as he paused on his back porch before he went in after a day's work, and he thought to himself, well done. He understood what well done was in a physical sense. And we must understand this. This was a busy man who knew how to do this in temporal things. Jesus said that the way this works in the kingdom is that when we use the talent that we have, we're given more. And when we're faithful in little things, then you can know they'll be faithful in bigger things. And so just take this man, Elisha. And if Elisha can plow with 12 yoke of oxen and be successful in that, Elisha can also be a prophet of the Lord and carry the responsibility and grow the work of the kingdom and go out and get something done. That's how it works. God didn't go find a man who was just, and I don't know what to say, sitting fishing from his back pond with nothing to eat today. I'm not picking on fishermen. He didn't call a man who was just sitting around collecting welfare. He called a man who was busy, a man who understood, a man who was working. Many of the same principles that made Elisha successful with 12 yoke of oxen, when that mind goes to work as a prophet, many of the same things that made that work will make the other work. And so this point is that Elisha was a man of power and success. And that does not stand in competition to the work of God, unless we allow it to. It actually is preparation for the work of God. It's a teaching. It's a classroom. And so that's who Elisha was. He was a man who could do some things. But this call would change his work life forever. This call would change his work life forever. He could not continue with 12 yoke of oxen and do what this call called him to in this sense. Sometimes power and success stand in the way of service. Sometimes Elisha's say, but I have 12 yoke of oxen, I must go and work them today. You remember the story that Jesus told about all the excuses that were made to come to the banquet, come to the feast that was prepared? Sometimes that stands in the way. Can you imagine Elisha out here? So why didn't Elijah come call him when all the oxen were put away? Maybe in a winter time when there wasn't fresh. Can you imagine the pull on a farmer who at the end of the day has a successfully plowed field and feels well done, but he's got Elijah's mantle and he's wrestling the call of the mantle or this fresh plowed field? His call came when the pull of the farm was the ripest. So power and success sometimes stand in the way of service, but I believe that temporal work provides training for ministry and service. Point number three in this story that I'd like to focus on is that the Lord called Elisha through Elijah. God often uses men in the church to direct in the calling of leaders for the church. We, as an Anabaptist church, we reject the concept of a man personally feeling a call to ministry, going off to seminary, learning to be a pastor, getting training, and then coming looking for a place that needs a preacher and seeking a job as preaching. We don't approach it that way. We believe the scriptures teach us to look out from among us. And so the call comes from the church. The call comes through men who lead in the church. Some similarities there in this. Now, I believe the Lord knew Elisha before Elijah met him. That's not a new thought to us, but verse 16 here in chapter 19. God told Elijah, "And Jehu the son of Nimshi shalt thou anoint to be king over Israel, and Elisha the son of Shaphat of Baal-Meholah shalt thou anoint to be prophet in thy room." He knew Elisha. And he said, "You go find Elisha and anoint him to be in thy stead." God knows each of us. And whatever the calling is, whether it is minister for this congregation, whether it is a school teacher, God knows, and God prepares hearts for the work ahead of them. And then God works in hearts that are called to help them to grow into the calling. It's all part of it. There's a powerful God. And so the Lord called Elisha through Elijah, through the man Elijah. And it was a call that would lead Elisha away from those, from the focus on those temporal pursuits to eternal pursuits of the kingdom. So this call came through Elijah, and we will see this in another point, but we'll see the strength of communion together, working together. We'll see this blessing of fellowship in a calling. I don't care whether you're called to be the first grade teacher or whether you're called to be the minister in a congregation. You need good people, good friends. You need this fellowship and strengthening of the hands and all of that. This was not a personal pursuit of Elisha that pressed itself upon the people. This was a call of God through Elijah, and it brought Elisha into fellowship with where he was called to labor, sons of the prophets. And there apparently was a school that where disciples, where youth learned some of the things of the truth. And so the call came through people. Elisha, as you follow his story, Elisha, both Elisha and Elijah found blessing from those who also were serving the Lord. One of the things Elijah was struggling with in this passage was, "I'm alone." And God said, "There's 7,000. Elijah would have done himself well to try to find more of those 7,000 and associate with. But it was a difficult time of Ahab suppressing the work of God. Number four point is that Elisha faced conflicts in this call. And so we talked a little bit about this. Elisha there plowing in the field, and here comes Elijah and calls him, and there's this great conflict, standing there wrestling. What will I do with this question? Elisha could have said, "Well, not this year, but another year." He could have said, "Well, God, why so inconvenient?" That's often the way the call of God is on our lives. It's often inconvenient. It's often not like, okay, that lined up perfectly because this job just ended and I was looking for a job and so they asked me to do this in service. And that's not generally the way it works. So there's conflict. The call of God often requires change and sacrifice. Ministry and kingdom work does not happen in a man's spare time generally. Now, men who love the Lord and are seeking ways to advance God's kingdom, when they have spare time, they can do something for the Lord in that spare time. I'm not suggesting that there's no way to do that, but I'm saying that it doesn't generally happen in a man's spare time. It requires some quality time, and that often requires sacrifice. God's call requires a conscious decision to follow his leading and do his work. And it's called Elisha to this work of being a prophet. And so he had a conflict over his parents and family. He said, "Well, let me go kiss my family goodbye." There's this conflict of "Well, I want my family to know what I'm doing." And there's this rightful look at how do I honor family in this call? And there was this conflict over his position in this farm. There's this this, what's he going to do with that? What's he going to do with all of this stuff? And he had a conflict over walking away from his passion, his farming, his success. There was a conflict there. This I know how to do. Do I know how to be a prophet? Well, I don't know. This I've spent years building up. This would be a new start. Those are all conflicts that he faced. And this battle, often in this battle, too many people lose, like the rich young ruler in Luke 18. When Jesus called him to, when he touched his possessions and said, go sell those things, he walked away sad because he wasn't willing to do what it took to be committed to God. Point number five then springs out of this point, and that is that Elisha's consecration rose out of this call and this conflict. In verse 22, it says, he returned back from him, took a yoke of oxen and slew them and boiled their flesh in the instruments of the ox. That he crossed a line. He said, okay, this I will do. I will accept this mantle. Elisha decided that God would be the first in his life. And he realized that God's call was more important than those yokes of oxen. And so Elisha's surrender would give him the position of a prophet of God. And as you read the story and you compare the work, it seems like Elisha's ministry, there's more miracles. There's Elisha's ministry was perhaps more powerful than Elijah's in the way we would measure it and counting up the different stories. And so Elisha's consecration, Elisha's commitment to God rose out of this call and this conflict. And so when this call comes and this conflict arises, some, like the rich young ruler, say, nope, not me. That's too scary. I'm not. But Elisha said, yes, I will go. He arose. And he made his commitment public in this. He burned his plow in the field. He made a barbecue for his workmen. Do you think any of those servants said, Elisha, you're crazy? Do you think any of them cried because they're losing their job? I don't know exactly what he did with the farm. It doesn't say if he sold it or if he gave, maybe he gave it to them or parceled it out. I don't know. But Elisha made his commitment public. The neighborhood would know that there's a new prophet on the block. The neighborhood would know that this man went all the way and he accepts it. And in order for Elisha's message to be powerful in the future, he needed this display of surrender that I am God, and he needed a clear call from Elijah. And it's true in ministry as well. A self-appointed person who's gotten there by self-wish and self-will, how well do people listen? But when the call of God is clear through the church, there's surrender on the part of the one called, it adds to the power of the message. None of the ordained men campaigned for the job, looked for it, and pushed themselves into it. But God called, and we surrendered. And that's what God wants in his church. That's his pattern. I believe that this kind of call from God, a call of service, a call of work, a call to some sacrifice, and the ensuing conflict, when we give it to God, it deepens a person's commitment. And that, you know, that will happen if the Lord tarries. We go into ordination work. We don't know how God will work, but if there's several men named, they will all have to look at, am I willing to? And will I do this? If God calls me, there's this deepening of commitment. There's this soul searching. There's this, a level of scariness, a level of wanting to compare, a level of wanting to say, could I do something more than my father's? You know, that whole. But Elisha's consecration rose out of this call and this conflict and working his way through it and God's clear call. And he answered and said, I will go. This this kind of experience that we're talking about often shapes relationships. The call of God shaped relationships with Elisha. He had a relationship with the men that were running those teams of oxen. And as he was called as a prophet, some of those relationships changed. He probably was still friends with those servants. He perhaps knew where they were. They perhaps cheered him on when he came through their town. I don't know. It doesn't say that. But he didn't just desert them forever. They were still his friends. But his relationships changed, and he became closer to Elijah. And it took him into other experiences where he learned to know other folks. And so this often shapes relationships. Some close ones to us change in nature. You have close friends before you're ordained. And then after you're ordained and you have some confidentiality as you work in the ministry, some things change a little bit. Doesn't mean we desert our friends, but some things change a little bit. And then what happens is sometimes we're called to work in leadership teams on a larger level, and you learn to know somebody. You learn to know somebody that you really didn't know before. Happens all the time as ministry are ordained in other congregations or other bishops. And then we get to ministers' meeting and we labor together on a subject and say, well, I didn't really know him before, but I hear his comments. I see, you know, how he works. And I'm learning to appreciate this, brother. It changed. The call of God changes some things in relationships. Well, number six, Elisha's call involved serving alongside Elijah for a while, for a number of years. Here in chapter 19 was this initial call, and then you read back through the chapters, Elijah is still leading out, and Elisha is, one place in the scripture it says that Elisha poured water on Elijah's hands, meaning he was a servant to just help with things as menial as providing the water to wash your hands with. And so Elisha's call involved serving alongside Elijah for a while. There was time to adjust and learn. There was experience to gain, to observe from other leaders. And I refer back to this struggle that he had earlier. He said, I'm not better than my fathers. But the reality is we're all human in leadership. And so as Elisha, a human, serves alongside of Elijah, he'll have to learn how to be faithful. How does Elijah make it? What does he do? What does he do when he's emotionally stressed, when he's really hurt, when he's really angry? What does he do? And there's some learning experience that goes along with that. And so Elisha spends time together with Elijah, and he learns what it means to be a prophet. Yes, he's given time. It's a beautiful thing if it can be accomplished where leaders have opportunity to overlap in the work. That's one of the reasons why leadership, it's a blessing to ordain leaders to begin in the work alongside of others and get a chance to see. But I would say on this point that for every public appearance of a leader, for every public appearance of men of God, there are private wrestlings. There are private wrestlings. And I believe that if you go back to how God showed himself to Elisha, fire and wind and earthquake, where the power really was in the still small voice. And I believe that as we're called, whether it's to teach, whether it's to preach, that the power of public duty is found in the connection in the still small voice, in private wrestlings, private worship, private connection to God to carry us through. Now, one of the things that I want to notice on this point, so they're serving side by side, where Elisha is serving Elijah. But if you go forward from chapter 19, chapter 21 is the time when Ahab took Naboth's vineyard. And God called Elijah to go and address Ahab. You know, I believe it would have been a temptation for Elijah to say, Elisha, you go. I already preached too much to Ahab. He wants to kill me and Jezebel. And you're my helper. You go do it. You're better suited to do it. But God called Elijah to go. And Elijah went and addressed. See, which verse is it? Verse 20. And Ahab said to Elijah, hast thou found me, O mine enemy? Can you imagine that job, to go talk to somebody like Ahab, as powerful as he is, and his wife wants to kill you, and probably he wants to kill you as well. And as you get there to deliver the message, he says, have you found me, O mine enemy? Well, so while God called Elisha to serve, do you think Elisha was walking alongside of Elijah? Think he was in the background? Perhaps he was. What do you think Elijah said as they walked home from that interview? What questions do you think Elisha had? Do you think Elisha said, Elijah, this is a scary calling. How do you ever do this? I don't know if I could ever address an Ahab. We don't know what transpired there. But God called Elijah to step forward and address Ahab. Perhaps Elisha was along, and Elisha got some idea of the reality that it's not all roses. There are some times that you got to go talk to Ahab. And you really don't want to go talk to Ahab. Your flesh says, no way. But God said, go tell Ahab something. And Elijah was faithful in that. What a tremendous example for Elisha. Don't shrink back when it's difficult. Well, it seems like there was no rivalry between Elisha and Elijah. There was no territory disputes of who would do what. There was no picking of the nice jobs and letting others do the hard work. They seem to have served together in a very wonderful way. Closing, I'd like to think about three practical encouragements for us from this call of Elisha. This call of Elisha. Three practical encouragements. Number one, be sensitive to opportunities of eternal value. See, Elisha had found the opportunities of farming, and he knew how to use them at the right time to produce good grain and all that. And now God was calling him to focus on some eternal values of ministry. Let's be sensitive to those opportunities, alert to them, and give them some priority. I believe there needs to be alertness for those opportunities in daily life. And I believe that when members are doing that in daily life, it's preparation for doing it in ministry. And that's one of the ways that we prepare. But there's this delicate balance of temporal work and eternal values. And you could take a message like this morning and tip it really heavy, that someone who's called to leadership will walk away from their job and all they will do is preach. And that's not how we experience it in our culture today, in our churches today. There's responsibility, and there's actually a blessing for leadership to be able to work and make a living. Face the same pressures. Face the same challenges. Live among us. We find that to be a blessing. And and yet in doing that, there's some sacrifice, and we must be careful that we are sensitive to the eternal values and not have the temporal values take too much of our time, that the eternal values that we're called to suffer. And so there's this delicate balance of finding our way, how much time for work and how much time for ministry, and how do you put that together? Number two, another practical encouragement is appreciate the privilege of working alongside of the faithful brothers. Appreciate the privilege. You know, one of the answers I had written down in my Sunday school book about the last question about things that hinder unity is this culture of self-expression that we live in today. There's really the strong push, and you just stop and think about all the places that the world pushes, I want to express myself. I want you to see who I am. And there's this pressure, this hidden pressure, when someone takes up a work, even like teaching school. There's this, can be this temptation to make your own mark and express yourself, and you will. Your talents will be seen. Your appreciations will come out, and people will see who you are in many ways. But this undue pressure to make your own mark and be more than your fathers were is dangerous. Appreciate working alongside of faithful brothers. Understand the value of not needing to always reinvent the wheel. There's good patterns going. There's good practices. There's things that have worked for many years. Embrace those. And then as you work with those, maybe the time comes to say, you know what? There's an idea. We could maybe change something and improve here. We must be open to that. I don't know if you're familiar with what's called Chesterton's rule. Chesterton's fence rule. Chesterton's fence rule says that you're not qualified to change something if you don't understand why it was there in the first place. And I'll just read a little excerpt from a little piece. It says this: there exists in such a case a certain institution or law, let us say for the sake of simplicity, a fence or a gate erected across a road. The modern type of reformer goes gaily up to it and says, I don't see the use of this, let's clear it away. To which the more intelligent type of reformer will do well to answer, if you don't see the use of it, I certainly wouldn't let you clear it away. Go away and think. Then when you can come back and tell me that you do see the use of it, I may allow you to destroy it. In other words, there's things sometimes that we come up to in life and we have no idea why they're in place. Let's remove it. After we remove it sometimes, we realize, whoa, wait, that was actually doing this. And we didn't understand it. So this idea of serving alongside of others, we balance it with this carefulness that many good patterns are set. And we should understand why we do. What is that doing for us? And as we get some experience with that, then we're at a place, once we know why did the forefathers put it there, then we might be at a place to say, okay, can we look at this? And I believe that there's two great dangers that the church faces. One is too much desire for change, and one is the impossibility of change. And those are two ditches that we dare not hit. And this point is trying to strike a balance. Carefulness in coming into the ministry, in helping out at Elida, Ohio, and their questionnaire for those that were in the lot, one of their questions is, are you willing to come in as an apprentice in the ministry and learn from others? We don't have that question in our thing, but it was intriguing to me because it's this point of working alongside, learning what are the things that have blessed us and how do we do this, and not trying to change out everything. Well, the last encouragement is embrace the conflicts that come with service cheerfully. Embrace the conflicts. There will be conflicts. We can choose whether the conflicts we face are a negative or a positive in our experience. I don't care what you do in life, there will be conflicts. There will be difficulties. We should pray for wisdom and fortitude to resolve the conflicts. We should allow the conflicts to remind us of our humanity and keep us humble. But we must embrace the conflicts that come with service. Embrace them cheerfully. And we must keep the big picture in mind in conflict and don't turn the focus on too much on people involved. Sometimes when there's conflict, like this with Elisha, he could have said, what is wrong with Elijah? He's not a very... He doesn't have much tact. He just came past in front of my servants and threw this mantle on me. He could have focused some attention of criticism on Elijah, but instead I believe he looked at the bigger picture. And when there's conflict, when there's things to resolve and difficulties to work through in the call and the ministry and all that's involved, let's be careful that we keep the big picture in mind and don't focus too much on the people involved. Well, may the Lord help us this morning to be inspired from the example of Elisha being called and learn some lessons for us in whatever calls and challenges and work that God has for us, that we would be faithful. And when we have done our part, and when we have said yes and serve, realize we're still unprofitable servants. And we probably haven't done much more than our fathers have done, but have done it cheerfully and let the results in God's hands, and to Him be the glory. Shall we kneel for prayer?